Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking with Matt Baglio, a journalist who wrote The Right, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, the story of the training that this Father Gary Thomas went through in Rome at the Vatican to become an exorcist and some of the wild experiences he had. You know, you have to wonder when a priest does this kind of stuff, when he encounters what he perceives to be demons, are there consequences? Do they face challenges or even dangers to their lives? And the answer is yes. We'll get into that and also hear about how people invite this stuff into their lives, why they become possessed, what they do to have these things come into their bodies. And some of these are some pretty chilling answers. We'll get more into that right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Matt Baglio, we were talking before the break about the names of demons, some of these same names pop up over and over. Did you speak to exorcists who encounter the same demon different times?
Sure. I mean, it can happen. I think the names are very popular in a sense. If you look at the mentioned in the Bible, those are the types of names that exorcists, you know, claim to hear the demon give. Again, I think this emphasis on the name, though, I've talked to a lot of exorcists who say it's not important. It's really just getting a name, whatever it is, so that they have a way to command the evil spirit. And again, this is the tradition. It goes back to the tradition of the Bible of the power of knowing somebody's name. And so there are various names that they hear over and over. Surprisingly, there are cases where the person will give the same name that they've heard earlier, but there won't be any connection. I found that to be a bit, you know, confusing. You know, if you hear the same name twice, why isn't the demon saying, you know, don't you remember me? You saw me earlier today. It's not like that, though. And in some cases, I was told that it could be that the name isn't the actual name, that it's perhaps that one of the demons is lying and saying a different name. However, it does occur that they'll pray over a person, and the person will give a name, and the demon will say, don't you remember me? We were in this exorcism, and will tell them about an exorcism that happened years ago or months ago in another environment. And sure enough, it's as if they were there watching that exorcism unfold. So it can happen where the names are the same, and the demon seems to know the exorcist, and then it can happen where the names are the same. And then it can also happen where the name seems to be just something made up, and the exorcist doesn't necessarily key in on that as that's the spirit. The name means the spirit. It just is a name I can command the spirit by.
I would imagine that, you know, they all come from the same place. If they're real and they're demonic, that they you know, you could say that they're all getting their energy from the big guy, the real one. And I just wondered, does Satan ever appear as a demon and take over somebody, the big guy himself?
Well, you know, I've been told that he does. I think this case that Father Gary saw, the Coke bottle, is a very, very strong one. He claimed, the exorcist claimed that was connected to Satan in some way. But, you know, you could say that an exorcist would say that all of these cases are connected in some way to the stronger demons. And Satan, of course, being the strongest. But it is very rare, I think, that something like that happens. Usually, and again, there's a hierarchy to evil spirits. It's very interesting. It's very fascinating. But there's a hierarchy to good spirits, and there's a hierarchy to evil spirits. And apparently, how it works in an exorcism is that the stronger spirits will hide, and they'll send the weaker ones out. And the weaker ones will then be sort of beaten up by the exorcist and cast out, while the stronger ones stay hidden. And they could be like considered like a general. So again, this going back to the name, if the spirit gives the name of this more powerful demon, it could be that they're working underneath that more powerful demon. But it's, you know, there's still some mystery to this. I mean, I have to be honest, there were times when none of the explanations I was given just didn't seem to answer all my questions. And exorcists themselves are quite honest, you know, that there is still a lot of mystery to this. It's up to God. This is all in God's hands. He's the one in charge at the end of the day. You know, evil spirits are created beings. They're underneath God. So we do our best. We do what we think needs to be done. We follow the ritual, and we help these people the way that we think we're, you know, best we can.
You know, you could have people make the argument that demons are more of a marketing device than anything, that the church uses them to scare the bejesus out of all of us and get us to convert. You know, that Satan himself is a creation, a hustle by the church, that, a boogeyman story to win converts through fear.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that approach to the idea of evil, even priests. I mean, Father Gary was giving a sermon, I think, and he mentioned the devil once in his congregation in California. And afterwards, a parishioner came up and said, "Can you please not do it again? Because you're going to scare my kids." So I do think in certain denominations, and or given the priest, it's a particular thing, they focus on this stuff and they want to use the devil to scare people. But I think it's important to remember, here we are, we're talking about evil spirits, we're talking about demonic possession, these kinds of things. But the exorcists themselves are they focus on the positive. They see a person who comes to see them. They're not thinking in their heads, "Oh my gosh, this is a demon, run for my life, I gotta, throw the holy water on myself," and all these kind of things. Thinking about it in the positive sense. This is a human being that needs help, that has opened a doorway to evil, that is suffering, and I can help them through the power of Jesus, through the power of prayer. And it's my job to do that. So they're focusing more on the positive side of it, which is, I want to help this person. And, in a way, when you go and see exorcisms, I think that's one of the things that really pops into your mind right away. You see a person. I think I was more afraid of the unknown before I saw one. And then you go into it and you see it and you realize that this person is suffering and they're just trying to have some relief. And so you want to help them. You want them to get better. So you're not necessarily focusing on the evil side of it, even though, as you mentioned earlier, these guys can be, attacked in various ways.
Well, how does a person open themselves up to this? It's not as simple as getting a tarot card reading or using a Ouija board or something like that. I'm thinking of this nun. How does somebody who's a nun open herself up to demonic possession?
Well, you're right. It isn't as simple, I think, as people want to make it out to be. It isn't that, and certain exorcists will say the same thing, priests, et cetera. If you go to a tarot card reader, if you play with a Ouija board, it isn't that you're immediately going to become attacked by an evil spirit. It's a much more complicated process than that. It could be that through a series of events, you eventually are sliding away from the good God, and then you start to play with a Ouija board or something, and you're curious about things, and you open yourself up in that way. In the case of the nun, I was told that she had been dedicated to an evil spirit when she was a child. She'd been come from Eastern Europe, and I guess I was told, again, I couldn't confirm it, but this is what the exorcist said, that she had been dedicated to an evil spirit. And that's one of the ways, apparently. The first way I was mentioning with the Ouija board, et cetera, is basically the occult. The exorcists say messing with the occult is definitely one of the most popular ways, if you will, that you can open yourself up to some of these kinds of attacks. Another way is through a life of hardened sin. And again, this isn't just sinning once. We all sin. We all have problems. And it isn't you're an alcoholic or you have any other kind of addiction or you have just been unfaithful to your spouse. It's more than that. It has to be a repeated thing that drives you away. And I look at it this way. We all have a window in front of us, an imaginary window, and the light from God shines through into us through this window. We do various things in our life that makes this window dirty. And after a while, the light can't come through anymore. And it's at that point that we're sort of opened up to the presence of these evil things. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily look at it as that these things come and approach us. And it's the other way around. It's that we do things in our own life that make it possible for them to affect us. So it's more of our own personal. We are in control. You're not going to be walking down the street. Somebody's going to pick you up and throw you across the street and attack you like you see in a Hollywood movie.
There are people.
Our own what? I'm sorry.
You make the point in the book. There are people though that go looking for it. That they do make a deal for their soul.
Yes. Well, that's the other way. They dedicate themselves to an evil spirit, and they go looking for it. And in this case, their windows would be, blacked up, and they want the evil, and they want this presence in their life. This is a way, I've been told, that they can become influenced by these evil entities. And it's the same. It works the same backwards, I guess, if you're going to dedicate yourself to being close to God, and instead you want to dedicate yourself to evil. It's a series of choices that you're making. It's up to the individual. And exorcist, the way I can put it is that you're doing things that drive you away from God. And it's more about yourself. It's more about your own personal needs, you know, all these kind of things, selfishness, whatever it is, you drive yourself away from God's, and then you could get into the occult or something like that, and you could open yourself up to that way. It isn't, but again, it's a mystery to it. And these exorcists, there were a couple of people they saw where they didn't know how it happened. One exorcist, you know, some exorcists believe in curses, that it's possible for a person to become affected by curses. Others don't. I'm on the fence myself, but I think if you believe in the power of prayer, then I guess you could say that this is the opposite of that. You know, it's wishing evil on somebody.
You make the point in the book that some of these exorcism processes are pretty rough on the exorcist, that they come out of it beaten up. They're drained. They're tired. In some cases, they have physical confrontations. But there are other consequences, I guess, that you mentioned sort of in passing in the book, that the things happen to them, that they that the priests have consequences in their own lives for battling against these demons, whatever the heck they are.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of priests, they don't want it to be involved in this ministry because of that. They're very scared of what could happen, fear of the unknown. And I think when you think about evil spirits and the potential of what that means, it's kind of very frightening in that you don't have any power over them as a human being. Obviously, you need the power that comes from God. So that's why exorcists kind of laugh at this notion that you should be afraid of demons. Many people, I think, are, you know, I don't want to think about it, I don't want to talk about it, and so it won't affect me. Exorcists, of course, they don't have that luxury. They're in the trenches, and they are attacked in various ways. They, you know, claim to be attacked through mental assault, if you will, you know, temptations, very strong temptations, things that you just can't get out of your mind. Some of them are physically attacked. They're pushed or kicked. You know, some of the saints have had the same experience. Padre Pio was another one who was, I think, pushed down the stairs at one point. And if you look at the lives of the saints and people who are, have this very close connection with God, they've been tormented in some way by evil spirits. And exorcists, you know, claim that it can happen both mentally and physically. And, you know, just odd things happen in their lives. One that your listeners may not think about, which is this idea that they get very disheartened because they're around so much suffering every day. I mean, imagine somebody who their life, their daily life for years is just filled up with people calling them saying, I'm going to kill myself today. I'm desperate. You're my only hope. And then they come in and everyone they see is just in their wit's end. They're about to, you know, ready to crack. And the exorcist has to pull them back from the precipice. And it can be very draining on them, and especially if these cases are very strong, if this evil spirit has been inside this person or connected to this person for many years, it's not easy to get rid of it. So they have to go through this very long process, and it can be disheartening for them. And many exorcists told me that that's the toughest thing for them because they lose faith. They think, you know, this prayer isn't working. Why am I doing this? These kind of things. And that is another attack, they say, that they have to overcome.
Didn't you use an example in the book about a priest who had performed exorcisms and then he's driving along a mountain road and his lights go out in his car, or I don't know if he blames it on the spirit or something like that, but I think that was one of the examples he used.
Sure, those are the extreme cases where the priest is driving his car and he's driving around a mountain road and at a very dangerous curve, at that moment the lights go out on their own. And, you know, I had another exorcist tell me that he was in his bed, he got up, he got a phone call, and this was a person who he'd been praying over, and they, you know, said, Father, I need a prayer, and they've got a real voice, and he gave him the prayer, and then he went back to his bed, and he was about to put his head down on his pillow, and he stopped because he saw motion, and looked, and there was like a scorpion on his pillow ready to sting him, and this is, you know, in Italy with scorpions in Rome, scorpions aren't necessarily a common thing. you could say it was, but I think the case of the car. In other instances where, you know, an exorcist is pushed, kicked, I had one exorcist tell me, I was a seminarian, I was helping in an exorcism, I was holding this person, and I was kicked, and I wasn't kicked by the person, I was kicked by something else, and it hurt, and they had a mark. Another exorcist was pushed out of a doorway, so those are the extreme cases where they get pushed and kicked, but, you know, you ask them, well, are you scared? How do you deal with that? And they just kind of, you know, it's all, we all have a cross to bear kind of thing. They all kind of deal with it.
What about for Father Gary? You make the point in the book, prior to him going to Rome to study this, that he had some of a kind of a weird accident. He doesn't exactly know how he fell off this cliff, and but it could be said that that's what led him to go there to Rome in part. And then you also make the point that he felt like he was being subjected to temptation, that suddenly he was on like ultra Viagra there in Rome, being tempted every time he turned around.
Right. He definitely described his experiences. He's very honest, very open. Again, as a, from a journalistic standpoint, he was a great subject for a book because he didn't hide anything from me. He was expressed everything that he was going through as an exorcist. And that's what I really wanted to try to convey in the book. You know, we all know the theology behind exorcism, or some of us may know it or not, but this is what it's like to actually be an exorcist and what it's like to undergo this ministry. And he was very honest about the fact that he was tempted very heavily with this sexual temptation, and it was very strong, and he couldn't get rid of it. And he eventually prayed, and he got through it, obviously, and he was able to deal with it. But there were other ways he felt attacked, and this one case, this very strong exorcism, the Coke bottles. I describe it as the Coke bottles because in this case, the woman looked at him. The majority of people are women that undergo exorcism. For various reasons. One exorcist says, stipulates that actually it's more men are affected, but men don't seek help. And women are more apt to seek help. Other people say, well, women are more in tune with the spiritual universe, this kind of things. But anyway, more women than men are go to see an exorcist. And in this case, she had the Coke bottles, which means her eyes were extra thick. Now, an interesting thing about Father Gary, he was an embalmer before he became a priest. So he's been around squeamish things. He's been around dead bodies for years. And he described the look that this person gave him as being the look of a dead body, that there was no soul. He could see something. It was very eerie to him. And the person looked at him. Again, most exorcisms, the eyes are shut tight. In some cases, the exorcist will pry the eye open and will see that the eyes have rolled up or down. In other cases, strong cases, the eyes will be open, but they'll be white, like you've seen in movies. But in other cases, the eyes will be open and the person will look. And this person just kind of turned the head and looked at him and stared at him. And in a way that he said reminded him of a dead body. And it was very creepy to him and eerie. And he got very emotional describing how he felt about it. And so I think in those instances, you feel kind of metaphorically, you know, naked in front of somebody that we've all struggled and stumbled in our own life. And is there an evil spirit that's been watching me this whole time and knows everything about me?
Well, how about for you? I mean, have there been consequences for you?
I haven't had anything that I haven't had anything negative happen to me. I mean, it isn't that I'm some sort of
Saint?
superhero. I mean, I didn't have the same experiences that he did. I think I watched this from the outside. I didn't enter into it in the way that he did. I was trying to be objective, look at both sides of this argument. I had a, you know, I had kind of had a positive experience where I had this sensation of smelling flowers, after seeing this exorcism happen. And I think I was more focused on the humanity side of it. You know, I was looking at the person and what they were undergoing and what that must be like for them. I think Father Gary was definitely more in tune with the spiritual side of it, so he felt affected by it in that way, and I think he had to take sides. That's his job. You know, I didn't necessarily have to take sides. So for whatever reason, you know, I didn't feel like that I had a personal connection to any sort of evil spirit in any way.
Okay. Matt Baglio, author of The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. Our conversation continues. When we come back, we open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest. Stay with us, everyone. More Coast to Coast to come. We're talking with Matt Baglio, author of The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. Spooky stuff, disturbing stuff. We'll go to the phones with your questions for him right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Matt Baglio, quick question before we go to the first caller. Any reaction from the church to your book, The Rite? Have they said, hey, job well done, thanks, we needed that? Or have they said, you're going to burn in hell for spitting this stuff out?
No, they didn't say that I was going to burn in hell. You know, I haven't, as far as an official response, I haven't definitely haven't gotten any, but I've gotten a lot of positive responses from priests and seminarians and other people about the serious way I went about looking at the topic. I mean, my goal in writing the book was to look at exorcism and I'll try to elevate it out of the sensational and really, you know, document my sources and just try to look at this in the modern light. And many have appreciated it. Lots of priests have said that it's very accurate. All the exorcists I've interviewed said it's very accurate. Some priests use it in their talks and these kind of things. But I've been, you know, quite pleased with the response it's gotten.
Well, it's a good book. I mean, you have an even keel. You take it from a journalistic standpoint. You're not preaching to anybody. I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the fact that you continue to write about this stuff. The version I have has an updated chapter or two in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the challenge for me because I am a journalist. I wanted to give respect to this world as a journalist should, you know, and really go into the research. I'm also very curious, so I tried to dig as deep as I could. I looked into science. I looked in, you know, to theoretical physics and talked to just about anybody I could to find out, you know, the reality of this world. And you know, that's exactly my goal. Was my goal in writing the book was not to shock people or sensationalize people. There are some shocking stories in the book, but was just to sort of report it as, you know, as I saw it.
Well, I would think that anything that makes it easier for priests and the public to talk about this stuff, that's a good thing. We're going to the phone lines. Wildcard line, Timothy in Wisconsin says he's a former priest who has performed exorcisms. Timothy, welcome to the program.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
The question I have, Matt, is how can someone who's been damaged by performing exorcism kind of heal or kind of reverse some of the damage that's been done? The exorcism I performed, which I think caused me a lot of problems, happened in 1999. And after that, my world fell apart. I lost everything. I had to be sent to a psychiatric hospital. And one of the things the entity said to me was the other priest and myself, that we would go to jail. And that became true. And it's been 13 years of great suffering, and I'd like to be freed from it. And so I just was asking any kind of advice.
Wow. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, Timothy, I appreciate the call. I mean, it's you know, it's very hard for me to say. I'm a journalist. I'm not a psychiatrist or a priest. But I would recommend that you proceed to talk to those two types of individuals. I mean, if you know of an exorcist in your somebody who's shared those experiences and you can talk to on a level and explain yourself and what you're going through, that I would imagine would be the first step to find somebody and that they would listen to you and not marginalize what you're going through or put you, you know, ridicule you in any way. And then obviously if you've been undergoing treatment through some sort of clinic, you know, to continue to do that. Many exorcists that I talk to, and they have people who come to see them, they will not tell them to stop taking their medicines and these kind of things. They will do both things together. But, you know, just try to find somebody, a group of people that you can share your experiences with that will take you seriously and sort of give you the care that you need. But, you know, I feel a little inadequate to tell you exactly what you should do.
Timothy, let me ask you this. Are you saying that what happened to you in your life is a direct result of performing the exorcisms? Do you have proof of that, or are you just a feeling, or just because this demon warned you that something would happen?
Well, whatever it was, wasn't successfully exorcised. And I went into it with all good faith and with the mandate of the bishop to perform a public exorcism. I had some training in that. So I felt I had some, and I went through the traditional preparations of confession and fasting, and I had another priest praying for me and so with me at the time. But I thought when I actually went through it, although it didn't have all the kind of, you know, scary Hollywood kind of pea soup sort of aspects to it, it was a profoundly disturbing event, and the fact that whatever it was, had intimate knowledge of unknown things, was the beginning of a vast downward spiral in my life.
Are you unable to go back to the church and talk to them about it?
Well, as I said, everything has kind of fallen apart, and I haven't found anyone. I used to be friends with Malachi Martin. In fact, I had gone to him for advice about this previous to the exorcism, and he told me, too, to beware, because he said that he had been pushed downstairs by an entity, and he warned me that the devil is like a chained dog, and you don't want to get within the reach of his, beyond the length of his chain, because if you get within that parameter, he has the power to hurt you. And I didn't think that was, bad advice, but I thought, well, this is a demoniac, someone I can help, and someone who's needed my help, and who I have permission to help in this way through the rituals of a church.
Was this the only exorcism you ever performed?
The only public exorcism. I had been training in Rome, as a matter of fact, with an Italian priest, and I had experience of performing what you'd call prayers of liberation, or prayers of deliverance, or private exorcisms and blessings and so forth. And I saw my share of kind of, I would say, ceo na coda. There's a tail there that's kind of left behind, a little bit of a telltale sign that there's something that's not of this world, without going into a lot of details. But it definitely was a life-changing event for me, and it wasn't a good change. But I'll take it off the air and let some other people talk. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Timothy, before you leave, if you wouldn't mind leaving your contact information with Gina, we'll keep it private. But I got a feeling that Matt and I know I would like to continue the conversation. I'd like to know a little bit more. So if you wouldn't mind leaving your contact info with Gina, we'll get back to you. Okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you for all you're doing. God bless
all right.
you.
Thanks for calling in. East of the Rockies, Sheila in Massachusetts. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call, George. Matt, I actually went to a Christian university and got a bachelor's in education and simultaneously got an associate's in biblical studies. And I did have opportunity to take part in very nominal ways in an exorcism that I was not the point person and I never want to be. But anyway... what I learned in my classical studies is that there, if you want to jump in, Matt, and say, yeah, I learned all that stuff. I want to share this, but I have a point for sharing it. There are three possible explanations for the nature and origin of demons. And these three possible explanations are thousands of years old in all of Judeo-Christian history. But there's also a fourth possibility that arose only in the past 20 years with the growing understanding of quantum mechanics and string theory. But anyway, the three classicals, again, Matt, if you've been there, done that, go ahead. The first of the three classical explanations are that demons are the exact opposite of angels. They're simply the fallen angels, and that the term demon and the term fallen angels are one and the same. That's problematic when you consider this bizarre desire for demons to possess people. It just doesn't make sense that they want to possess people if they are these wonderful, lofty, powerful angels. So it would make sense that they are actually some sort of a more lowly creature than the angels themselves. So the other two possibilities from classical scholarship are they are the disembodied spirits of evil, sinful people who didn't get to go to heaven. And then another possibility is that they are the disembodied spirits of non-human creatures that are sometimes referred to as the Nephilim, and that when humans die, humans get to go to either heaven or hell or purgatory. But these other creatures, when they die, they just get left behind like trash on the earth. They don't get to go to the great beyond, and that's the possibility of what these creatures are. And they don't like to be floating around without a body. They want to be in a body again, like they once were. There's a fourth possibility. This one, if you've encountered this one, can you talk about it? It's a relatively new concept, okay? So please give me your feedback on this one. It's possible that the mighty angels, the fallen angels, the evil fallen angels, they have the ability to project themselves in multiple directions on Earth and have multiple sock puppets going outward. And that in the first half of the show, there was the interview with the gentleman who unfortunately was host to that possessed woman named Roxanne, and that she would be like a sock puppet to the mighty angel known as Abaddon or Apollyon. And perhaps the mighty angel Apollyon has multiple sock puppets where he's possessing various humans around the world. And again, that would only be...
Well, Sheila, let me sort of cut this short, but I think that... that Matt did sort of address that in saying that one demon has a pipeline into a bunch of people, right, Matt?
Yes, I mean that's one of the mechanisms that's been described by one of the exorcists I talked to, who has a doctorate, and I find very knowledgeable, that the possibility that one spirit can affect more than one person, it's very real.
And I would say, Sheila, you're asking Matt to reflect on things that maybe are beyond his scope. Matt, as a journalist, you're not really sure about where demons come from. You're not even quite sure what they are.
Yes. I mean, I could tell you that the traditional teachings of the church, I mean, basically, the way that the church looks at this, and it fits in with the concept of demonic possession, is that demons are fallen angels, that God created angels, which are pure spirits. And in a way, that kind of also could fit in with quantum physics. You know, there are entities beyond the physical that we just can't understand because we have our five senses and we don't have the tools to comprehend other dimensions and these kinds of things. And they could be spiritual beings that live in another dimension. One exorcist said that that's a possibility. However, they're still created beings by God. They were given a test. Now, the angels were tested. A group of angels chose to sin, and they fell away from God. Now, this is a fall of their state of being because they're spirits. They don't live in a physical place. So they fell in a state of being. And if you look at the connection that I mentioned earlier, you know, we all need to maintain a connection with God. When you sever that connection, and again, this is looking at the Christian understanding of God. God is the source of love, the source of purpose in the universe. If you cut off that connection, you don't have love, you don't have your source of purpose, so you become very evil, closed off, and according to the exorcist, these entities then are fallen angels who want to steer us away from God. That's their job, so to speak. I mean, God still uses them in a way, and their job is to drive us away from God.
Sheila, thanks for the call. West of the Rockies, Dan, right here in Las Vegas. Good morning, Dan.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I have a story of an exorcism that I kind of accidentally performed. I wasn't planned. I was just a brand new Christian of maybe about 3 months. Went over to my mother's house, and my young teenage sister of about 13 years old was going through all gyrations. There were friends over at my mom's house, and her voice was changing, and she was yelling obscenities and writhing on the sofa like a serpent. And the ladies that were there asked me to pray for her. And I recognized right away what was going on, even though I was just a brand new Christian. And I began having a dialogue with my sister, and she couldn't really talk to me because the demon kept interrupting and saying things like, "You leave her alone. She belongs to me. She's my property," and all kinds of evil, nasty stuff. And I kept trying to speak with my sister, and I could draw her out once in a while. The voice that she kept speaking in, the demon's voice, was low and gravelly, just almost like the Exorcist movie type voice. Satan told me, "Leave her alone. She belongs to me." And I said, "No, that's not the case. She was bought by the blood that Christ built on Calvary's tree, and she belongs."
Hey, Dan, we're running out of time, so you're going to have to get to the point.
I'll make this really fast. I just told him, "Look, she was purchased by Satan. by the authority of the blood and the power of the name of Jesus Christ, you're out of here. And it happened instantly. And she opened her eyes and she smiled and never had a problem since. And it was much like the bumblebee doesn't know better. He doesn't can't fly physically, but he does it anyway because he doesn't know better. I didn't know you had to be a big old long theologian and all that kind of stuff to do that.
Well, Dan, let me summarize this for you. Matt, you make the point in the book that not everyone should perform exorcisms, that not even all priests should perform exorcisms, and even some of those who are trained in this stuff are not really good at it. What struck me also is that it's not a quick fix, that even an experienced exorcist using prayer, it doesn't always work. It's not automatic like garlic repelling a vampire or something. It's tricky stuff.
Right. I mean, I definitely am not an expert on who should and shouldn't be performing exorcisms. I'm just there to say this is what the church says. This is their way of doing it. Their way is to appoint official exorcists, and it can take time. You know, it's not a one-shot deal. However, exorcists have experience where this relief happens immediately and people seem to get better right away. So, again, there's a lot of mystery in this world. We're talking about things that are, you know, it's up to God. I'm a human. I can't explain the will of God, what he wants to do. But and no exorcist claims to either. They just put their head down. They have the ritual. They try to do the best they can and follow the teachings that they've been given.
What do you tell people if they're not a Catholic, or even if they are a Catholic, if they think they need an exorcist, where do they go?
Well, you know, I'm not going to refer people to an exorcist. I just don't feel comfortable doing that. But, you know, people have contacted priests, and that's really, in a Catholic church, that's the first step, is you talk to your priest, your diocese, and hopefully they're equipped to deal with that, and they're able to tell you, have you been to see a psychiatrist? Have you done this or that? Now, earlier, a caller mentioned prayers of liberation, these kind of things. Any Christian can pray a prayer over a person. I mean, that's, you know, in the Bible, the power of Jesus comes through his followers. What we're talking about is an official Catholic exorcism. So you're not supposed to do that unless you're appointed by your bishop and you're a priest. But if you're a Christian and you feel like somebody needs help, you certainly can pray a blessing over them. What's important to remember is that it's prayer. It's not violent. You're not supposed to hurt the person. You're not supposed to berate the person. Being attacked by an evil spirit doesn't mean that you are an evil person. It doesn't mean that you're going to affect them. It's not a disease. You can't catch a demonic possession by being in a room with somebody who's supposedly possessed by a demon. All of these are the things that exorcists with 20 years of experience have told me. So it's a prayer. It's about helping the person. It's about healing and being kind and in some cases just being an ear for the person to tell their problems to so that you could help them.
Matt Baglio, author of The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, thanks so much for being with us. And it's a fascinating book. I encourage people to read it. Also, thanks to Bill Scott, author of The Day Satan Called In, and to all my friends there, Premier, Dan and Gina and Lex, everyone. Thank you, everyone, and good night.